Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we're tackling a really interesting legal problem, one that has major implications for how we navigate the digital world, especially if you're thinking about a career in law. We're going to dissect the case of Arista Records LLC v. John Does 119. Think of it as like cracking a digital whodunit.
Yeah, what makes this case a standout is how it forces us to look at the friction between protecting copyright, you know, in the online space and the principles around online privacy. It's a crucial balancing act that the courts are constantly grappling with.
Exactly. So in this deep dive, we're going to unpack a significant lawsuit where some big music labels went after 19 anonymous individuals for allegedly sharing copyrighted tunes online. Our goal is to really understand the steps the court took in dealing with these copyright claims against people whose actual identities were, well, unknown at the start. We'll look at the essential pleading standards that record labels had to meet and the legal reasons why the court eventually allowed them to uncover the identities of these online users. By the end of our discussion, you should have a much clearer understanding of how this process works. Pretty valuable stuff for any future lawyer, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. This case lays out some, you know, fundamental principles about how copyright law is enforced in the digital age and what hurdles copyright holders need to clear.
Okay, so let's start by setting the scene. 10 major music companies filed a lawsuit against 19 unidentified individuals who are only known by their IP addresses. The core accusation was the illegal sharing of copyrighted songs using peer-to-peer networks.
And almost immediately, the plaintiffs made a move to speed things up legally. They sought what's called expedited discovery. Think of it as asking the court for permission to gather information, specifically to subpoena George Washington University, GW, the internet service provider, to reveal the real names and addresses behind those IP addresses before the normal discovery phase of the lawsuit.
Right. But it wasn't just, you know, an open door to get that information. There was resistance, and some really fundamental legal questions came into play.
Precisely. While the court initially gave the green light for the subpoena, both the anonymous users, the John Does and George Washington University, pushed back. The John Does filed motions to quash the subpoenas, arguing that the record label's claims were too speculative, basically saying they hadn't shown enough evidence to justify unmasking them, and that revealing their identities would infringe on their First Amendment right to speak anonymously online.
Mm-hmm. And GW University, as the internet provider, wasn't keen on handing over user data without a strong legal basis, so they also sought more time to respond to the subpoena. It created a real legal tug of war.
Exactly. At the heart of this legal battle were two key questions the court had to answer. First, did the music companies actually provide enough factual detail in their initial complaint to make a believable claim of copyright infringement? This brings in the Twombly plausibility standard, the idea that you need more than just, like, vague accusations to start a lawsuit.
Right, the plausibility standard. And the second big question was whether it was justified to grant expedited discovery to jump ahead and get those identities at this early stage of the case.
That's where the good cause test comes into play. The court had to decide if there was a good enough reason to allow this early access to potentially private information before the case had even, you know, really developed.
Okay, so let's dive into that first hurdle, the pleading standards. The John Does argued that the record label's claims were just guessing. What did the court say about that?
Interestingly, the court actually sided with the music companies on this point. They found that the plaintiffs had met the pleading standards. The crucial factor here was that the music companies didn't just make broad statements about infringement. Instead, they pointed to specific instances. They provided the titles of the actual copyrighted songs that were allegedly being shared illegally, and perhaps even more importantly, they included the copyright registration certificates for those songs.
Ah, okay. So it wasn't just a general claim of our music is being shared. They provided concrete examples of what was being shared and show they own the rights to it.
Precisely. The court specifically said that this level of detail went beyond what they called mere speculation. By identifying specific copyrighted works and backing it up with proof of copyright registration, the plaintiffs established a plausible case that copyright infringement had indeed occurred. This was enough to satisfy the Twombly standard right at the very beginning of the lawsuit.
Okay, so they cleared that initial hurdle by providing enough specific detail. Now let's get into the good cause test for expedited discovery that requests to quickly get the identities. You mentioned four conditions. What exactly were they?
Right. The court laid out four specific things the music companies needed to demonstrate to show good cause for getting expedited discovery. First, they needed to make a prima facie showing of copyright infringement. Now, prima facie essentially means presenting enough initial evidence that, if not challenged, would establish that infringement likely happened.
Okay. And how did the court determine that the music companies had met this first condition?
In this case, the court looked at the music company's allegations of illegal downloading and distribution of specific copyrighted songs. And remember, they had also provided those copyright registration certificates. This served as initial evidence that they owned the copyrights and that those copyrights were likely being infringed. So they had presented enough to suggest infringement had occurred.
Okay, that's the first part of the test. What was the second thing the court looked for?
The second criterion was whether the requests for information were narrowly tailored. In other words, was the music industry just trying to get a whole bunch of personal information about these individuals, or was their request specifically limited to what they needed to pursue the copyright claims?
And in this particular case, how does that play out?
Well, the court found that the request was narrowly tailored. The subpoena that was served on George Washington University specifically asked for the identifying information, the names and addresses directly linked to the IP addresses that were allegedly involved in the copyright infringement. It wasn't like a broad fishing expedition for all sorts of user data or online activity.
That makes sense. So they weren't trying to snoop on everything these individuals were doing online, just get the basic contact info tied to the specific alleged infringement. What was the third condition for showing good cause?
The third condition was whether there were alternative means to get this information. Did the music companies have any other way to figure out who these anonymous individuals were without going through the internet service provider?
And it seems the answer to that was pretty clear, right?
Exactly. The court recognized that the identity of the person behind an IP address at a specific time is generally known only by the internet service provider, in this case, George Washington University. Without the ISP providing that information, the music companies had essentially no other way to identify the individuals they were accusing of copyright infringement. They had hit a dead end without this subpoena.
Okay, so they had shown likely infringement, asked for only the necessary info, and had no other way to get it. What was the final piece of the good cause puzzle?
The final condition was whether there was a clear need for this information to move the case forward. Was getting these identities essential for the lawsuit to progress in any meaningful way?
And what was the court's conclusion on that point?
The court was quite direct here. They stated, and this is a really key point, defendants must be identified before the suit can progress further. I mean, think about it. You can't really sue someone you don't know, right? Without knowing who the John Does actually were, the music companies couldn't properly serve them with the lawsuit, couldn't engage in further fact-finding through traditional discovery methods, and ultimately couldn't pursue their claims in court. So yeah, the court agreed that all four parts of the good cause test had been satisfied.
Okay, so the court determined that the record labels had met the pleading standards and that there was good cause for this early discovery. But the John Does also raised some pretty significant concerns about their First Amendment right to anonymity and their general right to privacy online. How did the court deal with those arguments?
This is a really critical part of the case for understanding the balance between rights in the digital age. The defendants argued that their online anonymity itself was a form of protected speech under the First Amendment. They were essentially claiming a right to engage in file sharing anonymously as a form of expression. However, the court was not persuaded by this argument and firmly rejected it.
Why? What was the court's reasoning in dismissing that First Amendment claim?
The court's reasoning came down to the fundamental principle that copyright infringement is simply not considered protected speech under the First Amendment. The law has long recognized that there are certain categories of speech, things like defamation, inciting violence, and yes, copyright infringement that don't receive First Amendment protection. The court emphasized that the entire purpose of copyright law is to protect the rights of creators to their original works, and allowing people to anonymously infringe on those rights would completely undermine that purpose.
So the argument that this was some form of protected online expression didn't hold up because the underlying activity was alleged copyright infringement, which, well, isn't protected speech. What about their more general expectation of privacy online?
Right. The court addressed that as well, stating that in this specific context, the defendants had an exceedingly small expectation of privacy. The court reasoned that when individuals engage in online activities, particularly activities that could potentially violate the rights of others, they can't necessarily expect to remain completely anonymous. Furthermore, the court highlighted the fact that the subpoena was specifically limited to obtaining basic identifying information, names, and addresses, and wasn't a broad attempt to delve into their personal lives or all of their online activities.
So the limited scope of the information being requested also played a significant role in the court's view on their privacy expectations. Now, George Washington University, the ISP, also had its own concerns, particularly regarding student records and the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA. What was their argument?
Yes, GW University raised an objection based on FERPA. This is a federal law designed to protect the privacy of students' education records. Their argument was essentially that releasing the identifying information of their students in response to the subpoena would be a violation of FERPA.
And how did the court respond to that argument from the university? Did FERPA shield them?
No, the court also dismissed this argument. They pointed out that FERPA itself includes specific exceptions that permit the disclosure of student records when required by a lawfully issued subpoena. Therefore, the existence of FERPA didn't prevent GW University from having a legal obligation to comply with the court's order to provide the requested information in this case.
Interesting. So even a law designed to protect privacy has exceptions when faced with a valid legal demand like a subpoena. You also mentioned that the court clarified the specific legal rule they were relying on to allow the subpoena. What was that about?
Yeah, that's a bit of a technical point, but it's good to be aware of. Initially, the court had cited a specific telecommunications statute as part of the basis for allowing the expedited discovery. However, after further consideration, the court clarified that the more appropriate legal basis was actually Rule 26A of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. This rule governs when and how parties can conduct early discovery, including issuing subpoenas, and it requires a showing of good cause, which, as we've discussed, the court found to be present here. So while there was a slight correction in the specific legal rule cited, the underlying justification remained the same.
Okay, got it. Shifting gears slightly, there were 19 John Doe defendants, all included in a single lawsuit. Was there any legal challenge to doing that, to lumping them all together?
Yes, the defendants actually argued that it was improper to join all 19 of them together in one lawsuit. However, the court also rejected this argument. The court reasoned that the alleged actions of all the defendants were sufficiently related. They were all accused of using the same peer-to-peer file sharing system during a similar time frame to allegedly infringe on the same copyrighted works. This commonality of alleged activity was enough to satisfy the legal rules for joining multiple defendants in a single action.
Makes sense. And what about GW University's request for more time to respond to the subpoena? What was the final outcome of that?
After the court issued its ruling on the main issues, upholding the expedited discovery and denying the John Doe's motions to quash the subpoenas, GW University's request for more time to respond became essentially irrelevant, or moot, as lawyers say. Because the court had determined that the subpoena was valid and had to be complied with, there was no longer any need to consider granting an extension. They just had to provide the information.
Right. So looking at the big picture now, what are the key takeaways from this case, especially for future situations where copyright holders are trying to track down anonymous online infringers?
Well, for copyright holders, this case offers a pretty clear roadmap, I think. The key is to have specific evidence of actual infringement, not just, vague suspicions. And when seeking to identify anonymous individuals through subpoenas to ISPs, the requests need to be narrowly focused on obtaining only the necessary identifying information. This case confirms that courts are willing to allow this type of early discovery when those conditions are met.
And what about for individuals who might find themselves in a similar situation as these John Doe's? What's the lesson for them?
For potential defendants, this case sends a strong signal that simply claiming online anonymity under the First Amendment is unlikely to be a successful defense if there's a solid initial case of copyright infringement. The courts are likely to weigh the rights of copyright holders to protect their work quite heavily in these situations.
And what about internet service providers like George Washington University? What are the implications for them moving forward?
For ISPs, this case indicates that they can't necessarily rely on privacy laws like FERPA to avoid complying with valid legal subpoenas in copyright infringement cases. While they certainly have a responsibility to protect user privacy, that responsibility has limits when faced with a legitimate court order.
Okay, stepping back even further, What are the broader implications of Arista Records v. John Does for the ongoing tension between online privacy and copyright enforcement in our increasingly digital world?
Oh, this case definitely plays a part in that ongoing balancing act. It suggests that while online anonymity can be important, it's not an absolute shield, especially when it's used in the context of potentially illegal activities like copyright infringement. Courts are likely to continue to use the good cause framework established, or at least reinforced, in this case when they're asked to order the disclosure of anonymous online users' identities in similar situations.
It sounds like a word of caution for both sides, then. Copyright holders need to do their homework and be specific in their legal actions, and individuals can't just assume complete anonymity online, especially if they're engaging in activities that could infringe on the rights of others.
Exactly. And for any law students listening, this case is a really valuable illustration of how various legal principles intersect in the digital realm. It touches on civil procedure, things like pleading standards under Twombly and expedited discovery constitutional law with First Amendment issues, and federal statutes like FERPA. It's a case that's really worth understanding the nuances of.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating look at how established legal principles are applied to the unique challenges presented by the internet age. So to quickly recap our deep dive into Arista Records v. John Does, we've seen how the court navigated a copyright infringement lawsuit against anonymous individuals known only by their IP addresses. We examined the critical legal questions of whether the initial claims were specific enough and whether there was a good reason to reveal the defendant's identities early in the case.
Mm-hmm. We also discussed the court's reasoning for rejecting the defendant's arguments about First Amendment anonymity, emphasizing that copyright infringement isn't protected speech, and the limited expectation of privacy in such online activities. Plus, we covered why GW University's concerns about student privacy under FERPA didn't prevent them from having to comply with the subpoena.
So here's something for you to really think about for our listeners. Considering the rapid and continuous evolution of online technology and digital rights, how might the legal principles established in Arista Records v. John Does be challenged or adapted in future legal battles involving new forms of online activity? What new arguments might we see arise concerning anonymity and privacy in the context of, say, decentralized platforms, or maybe AI-generated content, things we can't even fully imagine yet?
That's a really important question to consider, isn't it? The legal landscape is constantly trying to keep pace with technological advancements. It would be really insightful to delve into more recent cases and see how the Twombly standard and the good cause test have been applied in newer digital copyright disputes. And of course, just following the ongoing debates about digital copyright and online privacy will be crucial for understanding how these legal principles continue to evolve.
Definitely a lot to consider. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive. Until our next exploration, stay curious and keep digging deeper.